From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Germany when a 9-year-old girl first learned about sex. Carola Siegel had seen her parents reading a book that they later hid from her, and one day she decided to find it. The book was The Ideal Marriage, Its Physiology and Technique, and she, at 9, found it riveting. One could later say that the book was the first that paved the way for her future career. Now, you know Carola Siegel better as Dr. Ruth Westheimer, the radio and television sex therapist who has been credited with revolutionizing the way that Americans talk about sex. Her life and work is the subject of a new play coming to the JCC Center Stage. In Becoming Dr. Ruth, the title character comments on why Americans turn to her for sex advice. She says, quote, "Why did they listen? I think it was this. People need to talk about sex, and suddenly, here was a little matronly woman who did. I was not threatening, and my accent helped. They thought I sounded like Sigmund Freud, and I made them laugh. A lesson learned with humor is a lesson remembered. I had gone from being a professor to a celebrity overnight. I was famous, and I loved it." End quote. This hour, we'll talk about that play. We'll preview it. We'll discuss Dr. Ruth's life as a survivor of the Holocaust. And we'll talk about how her grandmotherly accessibility enabled her to bring the topic of sex into the mainstream for generations of Americans. And I'd like to welcome our guests now. Ralph Maranto is Artistic Director of JCC Center Stage. It's always nice to have you back here, Ralph. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here. And I just want to say, Evan, that you actually recited some lines that are directly in the play, Becoming Dr. Ruth. So if Karen gets sick at any point, I think I have my understudy.
I don't know if I'm the best to play Dr. Ruth, but Karen Bowersock is the actor who plays Dr. Ruth, who also happens to be Artistic Director of the Bristol Valley Theater. Karen, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us in studio is Dr. Pebble Kranz. Dr. Kranz is medical director of the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness. Dr. Kranz, welcome to the program.
Delighted to be here.
And Bill Kelly is here, who is a licensed clinical social worker at the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness and a diplomat in sex therapy, which, Bill, it's worth reminding the audience how you become a diplomat in sex therapy.
Well, first of all, you become a certified sex therapist through an organization called the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. And it's a fairly rigorous criteria. It takes most people 3 to 5 years to get through that. And then if you've been practicing 15 or more years and you've done a service to the organization and done some work in the field of human sexuality that's gotten recognition, you are invited to be a diplomat.
Well, welcome. Thank you for being here. Thanks for bringing your expertise to the program. Ralph, you have shared in the past, and I'd like you to share with our audience, a funny little story for not only sort of how this started to come together, but how the woman who's going to be Dr. Ruth on your stage here, who is going to be a great Dr. Ruth, sitting here
incredible.
With Karen, you can tell.
She's absolutely incredible.
How did this all come together?
Yeah. Well, so first we decided to do the show. It's been done by a lot of theaters across the country. I've been talking to the theaters that have done it, and it's incredibly well received because it's so thoughtful and entertaining, and it's about this really amazing person who paved the way for others. And I think without reflecting on what happened in your last hour here on air, Evan, all of our shows this season at Center Stage are about game changers. They're about people who, by being themselves and speaking up, kind of change the course of their world that they were in. And the power that one person can do that. And I think Dr. Ruth really reflects that. She was able to speak up and talk about sex at a time when other people didn't, and it changed the way Americans talk about sex. So we picked the show because we knew we had to do it. It's an important Jewish story. It's an important story for America. And then I figured, well, we'll figure somebody out. We'll do auditions like we always do. There'll be a lot of women who will want an opportunity to do this. And then literally I was sitting at a wedding. Karen and I have known each other for years. I've seen her perform, and I know what an amazing performer she is. But we were at a wedding for a couple of actors that we both had worked with who were getting married, and she was sitting across the table from me, and I was reminded of her diminutive size. And I was just watching her body language and her joyousness, and I just walked over to her and I said, "Karen, are you familiar with the play Becoming Dr. Ruth?" And she just lit up and laughed, and I knew I had found my Dr. Ruth.
Did you know that you were going to be Dr. Ruth at that moment? Was it too late to even try to back out?
Well, when Ralph said, first said, would you be interested in, do you ever do any acting outside of Bristol Valley Theater? And I said, well, yeah. And I pictured in my mind, you know, a little cameo performance in some wonderful play that they were going to put on. And when he said, becoming Dr. Ruth, I what could I do but laugh? I've been short my entire life. It's nice to be able to cash in on it.
It's about damn time. And how familiar were you? I mean, Americans are familiar with Dr. Ruth, but how familiar beyond just sort of the basics were you?
I had no idea of her story, of the story that you're going to hear in Becoming Dr. Ruth, of her childhood, of her, you know, in Nazi Germany, losing her family, going to Switzerland on the Kinder transport. And that's just the beginning. Spoiler, I don't want too many spoilers, but she went on to do remarkable things for the, and is still at 90 doing remarkable things and writing books and doing appearances. And she's in some commercial right now. So she, I didn't know any of that before reading the play. And that's what hooked me. That's really what hooked me.
How good in general are your accents?
I would have to say I'm fair. Pretty well,
no,
more than
no,
fair.
No, they're incredible.
I did a show this summer that was an Irish dialect, and so I was preparing for that before this one. So I didn't start this one until that one was done.
I'm always curious to know how you go about doing an accent, particularly if it's one you haven't done before. Is there a technique that helps with that?
There are all kinds of recordings available, thanks to the internet, so you can listen to either actual speakers or you can listen to somebody who says, you know, who gives you a class in it online. However, with Dr. Ruth, there was plentiful material.
Yes.
I mean, I already knew what she sounded like, and if I had any questions, I remember the first sentence that I came up with for myself was, I really want to go back to Switzerland, and which was an odd thing because she had no desire to go back to Switzerland, but that's the sentence that I came up with, and I would practice that, and from there, it just took off.
Okay, and now when you listen to her, Ralph, when you listen to Karen and you listen to Dr. Ruth, do you feel like we're pretty well on the mark here?
Yeah, she's doing an incredible job. She's really captured the voice, but more than that, she's captured the spirit of this woman.
Yeah.
And that's what's really, really important. And the set design that we have has these picture frames on it. And at first we thought we were going to put actual pictures in there. And then we realized that takes the audience away from looking at Karen as the actual Dr. Ruth. So now they're just kind of empty picture frames, and then as she talks about them, then your mind visually fills in what's happening. She's really captured the spirit of this incredible woman in an incredible way, and I think audiences are going to really love it.
All right, the show is Becoming Dr. Ruth at the JCC Center Stage. When, by the way?
We open tomorrow night, the 6th, and run through the 21st on Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays.
All right, so you've got a chance to see it, and you can get tickets where?
At jccrochester.org or call 461-2000.
All right, so let's talk about sex. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things. And it's Friday afternoon, and I'm tired, and I'm quoting song lyrics. So I want to turn.
Go for it.
I know. The people behind the glass are just so disappointed. I see it. Rob and Megan are just, oh, my gosh. I want to ask Bill and Dr. Kranz first how they view the legacy of Dr. Ruth's work in this field. And, Bill, for you, as a sex therapist? I mean, what's the shorthand term?
Yeah, sex therapist.
As a sex therapist.
Shorthand term.
What's the impact of someone like Dr. Ruth?
Well, sex therapy really came out of Masters and Johnson's work in 1967. And ASEC, the organization, was formed around 69, I believe. And we were sort of in our own little world. People would come and see us. There was actually a talk show with Matt Rinaldi here many years ago in the early 70s with two people, Charlie Pearsall and Roselle Fine, who just passed away last week. And so it was being talked about in the early 70s. But Dr. Ruth really took it out of the closet in a way that we were unable to do, because I think she had that personality that Karen is going to display for us when I go see her on the 11th. She had that personality you've already talked about, which is, it was grandma talking to you or mom talking to you in this very open and freewheeling style. And I had an opportunity a number of times to meet Dr. Ruth, because she was an active member of ASECT. And she was as vivacious in person as she is on the radio or television. So she really brought us out of the closet, to speak. And people began to talk about sex that was way away from just the locker room stuff. It was serious stuff now.
Serious in a way that was more healthy, more direct?
Most of it was healthy. I think in terms of it was mostly male-female. As it evolved, I think it opened the door for male-male, female-female. And then we began to see some of her influence, I think, when Don't Ask, Don't Tell was coming through in 93. People were already sort of prepped to begin to talk about sexuality. And I think what happened this morning in Washington, D.C., gives us another window about another aspect of sexuality, and that's sexualized violence that we really hadn't had before. But she was talking about, she was doing what a former Surgeon General Everett Koop called an organ recital. So Dr. Ruth did a lot of stuff just on the basics of where all the parts were and what they were supposed to do. And that was a revolution because people really didn't know how their bodies worked before that time. And of course, she learned that at New York Hospital, Cornell, under a person named Helen Singer Kaplan. And so she revolutionized and gave permission. And permission is in sexual counseling and sex therapy is the first step. We give permission for people to talk about sexuality. And then most people correct whatever concerns they have simply by giving them permission. And that's what she did.
And Bill, you've been a licensed sex therapist for how long now? Since when?
Well, I was trying to figure that out. So I began doing sex counseling when I was at a children's agency. It was mostly sex education. Mm-hmm. And then when I went back for my master's degree, I became what's called a sex counselor, which is a lesser degree in 79. I don't know how I could do that because I would have been five at the time. But,
but you don't have to date yourself, but yeah. It's been some time. But the better part of four decades.
1985, I got the status of sex therapist.
And the reason I ask is because your career is really tracked with the early days of the success and the rise of Dr. Ruth in sort of popular culture and the popular understanding. So I'm curious to know how your work, if it has changed, what your focus is on, the work, either the stumbling blocks to people either communicating or understanding sexual health. How much change have you seen?
Well, there is a great evolution. So in the early 90s, late 80s and early 90s, my practice changed to a lot of people in transition from one gender to another. And also, I became an advocate for simple things like bathrooms, where they could use a restroom that reflected the gender that they felt they had. So that was stuff that Masters and Johnson never talked about. There was a lot of people in the community coming out and celebrating who they were and who they are in terms of being gay, bisexual. So a lot of my work changed to that, running groups for gay men, and less on sexual functioning, because mm-hmm. that was my original training, which was Masters and Johnson, Sensei Focus, all those things. And then, of course, we had something called Viagra emerge. And
For hearing loss.
Yeah. And that became a great, I'm trying to find the right words here.
It was a game changer.
Yeah, it was a game changer. Thank you, Ralph. And so we were much more connected now with medicine than we had been before. And I also had an opportunity to do the study for Viagra for women, which didn't work at the time. But that also started the pharmaceutical companies looking at what are the elements that would be replicated in a pill that Viagra and other cytidiol kinds of drugs do. And now my practice for many years has been about sexualized violence and helping people have a healthy sexual relationship or relationships, because the focus, as we saw this morning, is about this topic that we really haven't talked about.
Well, let me turn to Dr. Kranz for your thoughts, first of all, on Dr. Ruth's legacy and how it's impacted your field of work.
Well, the field of sexual medicine has really exploded in the last 15 to 20 years. There's so much more research on even anatomy of women and sexual function and possible treatments. So there's been big change in the field as a whole. I think Dr. Ruth had an enormous impact in terms of bringing sexual issues and conversations about sex to the public and making adults feel like they had a resource to get some additional sex education where they felt at sea with their own sexual issues. Most of us with sexual issues sort of have a sample size of one to understand what's quote unquote normal. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Ruth helped people understand that there was a safe place, that the world was a safe place to ask your questions and get good information. And now we have a number of different resources. There's Dan Savage of the Savage Lovecast that people ask their questions of. There's Love Touchpoint in New York City, which are these sort of wild town halls where they have 50 people on pillows and they're recording the conversations and questions about sex and sexuality and relationships. And she really made it clear that there was, Dr. Ruth really made it clear that there continues to be a thirst for a place to get those questions answered to not feel so alone. I think one of the things that she said that she saw the most was premature ejaculation and problems with orgasm. And these are issues that people hold close to their heart and don't have places to get good information about. The world is full of lots of bad information about sexual function, and she helped people feel that there was a safe place to get that information, and that need continues.
Speaking of male-female relationships, did she help women advocate for themselves or think about sex in a different way, perhaps?
Absolutely. I think that she really, her contribution was really focusing on pleasure, that it wasn't about performance. A relationship, you know, no matter the genders involved, was about pleasure and satisfaction and a sense of closeness and intimacy. And so she really changed women's expectations about what they should expect from sexual encounters.
Yeah, and you know, I can't help but think about some of the conversation we've had. You know, Bill brought up the Kavanaugh hearings, and I don't want to make any sort of comment directly on the allegations regarding him, but I do want to ask you about some of the national commentary that has said variations of girls, young women have to be careful because if you're at a party, boys will be boys. You put yourself in this position. If you're drinking, if you're going upstairs, you know, you don't know. And that to me, obviously I've got all kinds of problems and I'm very curious to hear what the experts are thinking about what you're hearing in these conversations. But one thing that also comes up to me that maybe relates to Dr. Ruth is this, the lack of equality as we think about sex, that sexual interactions are something for especially young boys, but men to pursue when women to withhold or give up as opposed to enjoy together. And that sort of paradigm exists in the way that some of the conversation has had around these kinds of incidents.
Well, I think that we're doing a lot better in the sex education of young people now around the issue of consent and the importance of affirmative consent. And when that isn't present, nothing should proceed, no matter whether alcohol is involved, no matter whether you've gone upstairs. The consent needs to be clear and affirmative and enthusiastic. And that a non-consensual sexual situation is damaging for all parties involved. It's damaging certainly for the person who is the victim in that circumstance, but it's also damaging for the perpetrator as well. And I think that improving our national conversation around consent is important. Kids are getting the message a little bit better in school, in school sex education, but I don't think adults have that conversation down so well.
And Doctor, if I could, because you brought up the phrase affirmative consent, that has been sort of debated in a way that some critics have sort of mocked this idea that, you know, every step in a sexual interaction, does it require a contract? And, you know, you're going to take some of the actual excitement out of what should be a physically exciting situation. And some of the critics have said, you know, that's unrealistic and that people can still communicate without verbal direct cues and that we're asking too much.
Well, I do think consent can happen in a variety of ways.
Okay.
You need to be clear on your communication with whoever you're playing with, though, because if you don't understand that person's language around consent, if you don't know them well enough to know that expression, that look, that kind of touch is a language of consent, then that's a problem. So we need to expect that there's going to be a lot of communication that needs to happen for people to get to a point where they don't have to use language to establish consent. And I sort of feel like, when is enthusiasm ever unsexy? You know, yes, I want it. That is sexy. That's not a limiting factor on a playful situation.
Okay. Bill, how do you feel about that?
Well, I was thinking consent. Actually, there's six questions to ask and answer with a potential a sexual partner, whether it's a long-term partner or someone you've just met. And the first question is, do you find me sexually attractive? And now, it may not be physically attractive, but it may be due to monetary reasons or whatever. But yes, okay. The second question is, would you like to have sex with me? Because there's a lot of people that one might find attractive, but for lots of reasons, you wouldn't have sex with the person. The third question is, if we had sex, what would we do? So now we're talking, we're negotiating so that everybody's clear about what we're going to do. The fourth question is this a long-term relationship? Is that where we're heading? Are we thinking about picking out the China pattern? Or is that just sex? And the last question, or the fifth question, is your place or mine? Where can we do this safely? And obviously for adolescents, that's a big question. People with disabilities, that's a big question. And the last is more of a statement than a question. We can stop and start at any time, okay? And so there's a guy named Michael Chernoff with the Gay Men's Health Crisis in New York City, and he wrote a manual on negotiating safer sex. And so from that, during the HIV crisis, not that we don't have that now, but when that emerged in the early 80s, many of us were doing workshops on how to negotiate a safe sex relationship or safer sex relationship. And I think for most people, it didn't ruin the moment. It made people safer. And so it's something that many of us, when we're doing lectures or presentation, or when we have someone in the office, that's often what we're talking about is, how do you do consent? I think the other stuff is overblown.
Well, look at the kinds of conversations generated thanks to JCC Center Stage. The reason we're here is the JCC Center Stage is getting ready to kick off, season 42?
Yes, 42. Becoming Dr. Ruth opens our season tomorrow night on October 6th.
And it runs through?
Through the 21st of October.
All right. So after our only break of the hour, we'll come back and we're going to talk some more about these, the various subjects that we have been exploring this hour. We're going to ask Karen Bowersock, the actor who plays Dr. Ruth and artistic director of the Bristol Ballet Theatre, what surprised her most in the background of this remarkable person? Because as Karen told you earlier this hour, everybody knows Dr. Ruth in some way, but most of us don't really know the details of her personal story. And it is an amazing personal story. I reserve that word for truly amazing things. And this is a woman with an amazing personal story. So we'll talk about some of that. Ralph Maranto from JCC Center Stage is here. You just heard Bill Kelly, who is a sex therapist and licensed clinical social worker at the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness. And the director, the medical director there, is Dr. Pebble Krantz. So let's go ahead and get our only break of the hour and come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections. No matter where you stand on Judge Brett Kavanaugh, there was a part of the discussion that came up over the last few days when the New York Times reported on his days at Yale, in particular when there was a bar fight. Some of Judge Kavanaugh's defenders argued that all men get into bar fights or fist fights. We'll talk about that assumption that men are violent Monday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to ask Ralph Maranto to just remind our listeners, because we had a good conversation. We're having a good conversation about sexual health, what has changed over the decades, particularly since Dr. Ruth hit the pop culture scene, which was really in the, I guess, the early 1980s, right?
Right.
Which we're going to learn more about in the show, Becoming Dr. Ruth. But why don't you reset for our audience why we're here? Because you guys are telling the story of Dr. Ruth.
Yeah, well, you know, most people know who Dr. Ruth is as America's favorite radio and television sex therapist. And the story behind how she evolved from being a orphan who escaped Nazi Germany on the Kinder transport to being on David Letterman and laughing about crazy things, including women throwing onion rings onto erect penises for David Letterman to get up and walk off the stage in the middle of the conversation. The path of from one to the other is the story of the play Becoming Dr. Ruth, which opens the center stage season tomorrow night, October 6th, runs through the 21st. And we're here with Karen Bowersock, who is playing that incredible, iconic woman.
What surprised you most about her in her biography, her personal story?
I would have to say her military experience when she was in Israel. She was a sniper in Palestine. She learned how to take a machine gun apart and put it back together with her eyes closed. And when you picture our version of Dr. Ruth, she's a little matronly lady. She was very small. She was spunky and she's outspoken. But to picture her in as you know, standing on a roof with a rifle, looking down over the barricade at the city gates of Jerusalem or of Palestine, you know, that was something unimaginable for me. She did so many things that now I have to, as playing her, imagine what that felt like. Imagine what that it's hard to pick one, but I think that one would probably be the most.
And so, how much is your own creation in terms of the way you present her on stage, and how much is really that careful study that you talked about?
Well, as I said, there's a lot of evidence of what she sounded like,
absolutely,
how she moves like. There are books. She has an autobiography, which I started to read, and then I stopped because there were discrepancies. Mark St. Germain, who wrote the play, you know, wrote a play based on many interviews with her, I am sure. But sometimes there are took dramatic license. There are characters that are amalgamated or switched around for the dramatic content of the play. And I also think the book was published in the 80s, and reading about, and the play was in the 90s, and I think her opinions about things changed. So I found that the book was making my head a little crazy, trying to figure out which Dr. Ruth I was playing, and I didn't want to confuse myself because it is she in the play, she's obsessed with dates. That's how she got. She was taught at an early age that dates are how we know who we are, by remembering who we were. And so there's a lot of dates to remember, and I didn't want anything to interfere with that. So I put the book aside, and I went back to it when I had questions about, I don't understand, how did she really feel at that age about Palestine? And then I could go back to the book and look and get that information. But in terms of heavy research of reading up on her, I did more research of the live Dr. Ruth.
I think this is a question for both of you, because, you know, for you as a performer, it's one thing. For Ralph as with the JCC center stage, it's another. You want the audience to enjoy themselves always. I mean, really, you're coming out for a night of entertainment.
Absolutely.
But ultimately, you also want the audience to maybe go home with maybe a different understanding of the world or a person or a concept or an idea. So for you, as playing Dr. Ruth, what are you hoping the audience will leave the JCC center stage with?
Well, she makes it easy because we look at her even today and she is full of this zest for life. So even though she's telling stories of great sadness in her life, experiences that were difficult, challenges that she had, she was taught at a very early age by her grandmother to be a people pleaser, for lack of a better word. Her grandmother said, always be cheerful, always smile and be cheerful, and remember that you are loved. And she says repeatedly through the play that love that she had in the first 10 years of her life carried her through all of the experiences that she had along the way. And it is, I still think, in her makeup today. So that's how you can take, I can take these people on this journey through some of the difficult parts of her life and the challenging part, because she always is looking forward, because she always is looking to the positive. And that's what makes the experience a positive one for the audience.
And I think that the other thing the audiences will walk away from after seeing a play about Dr. Ruth is not just to go, wow, what an amazing woman who had an amazing life, but to also see how she created her amazing life, which was by being unafraid to speak her mind, by being unafraid to take on challenges, to have something knock her down. She would say, fine, if that didn't work for me, I'll go on and do something else instead. She had 3 marriages, and she was unafraid, even at an early age, to say, you know what, this isn't working, let's stop and let's move on. If she hadn't been able to do that many, many times in her life, to just reinvent herself and push herself forward and speak her mind, she never would have been the kind of person that talked in front of a room full of radio producers and somebody said, let's give this woman her own radio show. And it was just because of who she was as a person. And I hope that inspires people to be also unafraid to speak their minds and do what they are passionate about.
You mentioned a David Letterman appearance. Was there one, I'm trying to think of the other media appearances, you know, the daytime talk stuff. Was there one above others that sort of launched her in her career?
Well, it was radio, really.
Mm-hmm. Radio?
Yeah, so she was working for Planned Parenthood, and a group of radio producers wanted somebody to come in and talk to them about these issues that were being discussed at Planned Parenthood so that they could deal with how to talk about them on the air. And so she went in and spoke for 15 minutes, and people asked questions, and someone said to her, we want to start a show with you. And it started as a 15-minute broadcast at like midnight or something. Yeah, and it was so popular that it went to an hour, and then it got expanded, and then it went national from being a local show to a national show, then internet. National, then television, and it just, you know, snowballed from there.
Hmm. Well, I think of my own upbringing. My parents never had, to the extent parents do this, my parents never had the talk with me. Mm. Now, I feel somewhat for my son, because when he's of age, and we're going to talk about what of age means in a moment, but when he's older, I'm going to be very explicit about my expectations. Mm-hmm. And in general, yeah, how I expect him to behave, to conduct himself. But the question of when you start that process is an interesting one. Dr. Ruth made it easier for people to understand that they could talk about it, that you could talk about it with family, that you could talk about it with kids. And recently, the Atlantic Monthly wrote a piece about sex ed in the Netherlands. And I want to read a little bit from this, if we could, and ask our guests about this, because they have, I think it's fair to say, a pretty different approach. Though it's also fair to say that in this country, it's really a state-by-state thing. We have abstinence-only education in almost a contiguous block of the American South, which happens to coincide with the highest rates of unintended teen pregnancy. But
and STDs.
Yeah, it's just true. I mean, again, mm-hmm. that's not a commentary. That's just looking at numbers. Mm-hmm. But there's state-by-state is different. But on the whole, we're not quite where a lot of Scandinavia is and other parts of Europe. So let me read from this piece in the Atlantic Monthly. And this is what the author of the piece, Bonnie Ruff, wrote. Quote, while researching my book on sex education, I observed how Dutch parents, healthcare workers, and educators achieved these public health results by being almost unbelievably open with children of all ages about bodies and relationships. And in part because of its low teen birth rate, the Netherlands ranks as one of the most gender-equal countries in the world, placing 3rd on the United Nations Development Program Gender Inequality Index. The U.S., meanwhile, doesn't even crack the top 40 on that list. These are the numbers. On average, Dutch and American teenagers have sex for the first time around the same age, between 17 and 18 on average, but with dramatically different results. Teen pregnancy has been on the decline in the United States for the past three decades, but American teenagers still give birth at five times the rate of their Dutch peers, who also have fewer abortions. In the United States, people under 25 make up half of all new STI cases each year, while young people in the Netherlands account for 10% of new cases in that country. Again, that's Bonnie Ruff in The Atlantic on a recent piece. And so the takeaway, I think, Dr. Krantz, is that this is a country that is really sort of Dr. Ruth writ large in how it approaches education, you know, from the start, unafraid. And I don't think that means at 4, 5, and 6, it's explicit sex, but it's openness to talk about body. And from the start, age 4, we're talking healthy relationships, what it means. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how you view that vis-a-vis what's going on here.
Well, I think one of the things that approach in the Netherlands makes clear is that it's useful for parents and children to have continuing open communication about sexual issues and values and thoughts and beliefs about sex. One of the things that we do in this country is we encourage a atmosphere where kids feel like this is something that they do and don't talk about with their parents, that they need to keep it very separate from their parents. Their parents don't want to talk with them about it. Parents don't want to know about it. There's a wonderful book called Not Under My Roof that sort of examines these differences in that Netherlands approach and the U.S. approach, and that our approach being one of this isn't, it's not allowed, not under my roof, takes away the opportunity for parents and children to continue to discuss not only sexual safety, but also sexual pleasure. I think one of the most important conversations for parents to have with their children is about their children pursuing their own pleasure and getting pleasure from sex, that it's something that should be good in our lives. It's something that is a crucible of wellness. One needs to be physically well, emotionally well, psychologically well, spiritually in a good place, also all of those things in order to really enjoy sex. Our expectation that kids are just going to kind of figure this out on their own or figure this out on their own with the help of the internet or figure this out on their own with just the help of school sex education is really limiting for kids and for parents.
How are schools, to the extent that you're working with and aware locally, how are they doing? Is it changing? What do you see?
Yes, it is changing. There's a good curriculum that's being used based on the circles of sexuality in most of the schools, I believe, across Monroe County. There's a wonderful new curriculum being designed in New York, that's being rolled out across the schools in New York City by an organization called Advocates for Youth. Curriculum is called Rights, Respect, Responsibilities, and it's a kindergarten through high school curriculum. Coming to your point of this is a conversation that we need to start having when kids are very young. They need to know their body parts. They need to know how their bodies function, and they need to not feel like it's a shameful, dirty thing to have a body that has parts. And there's, you know, certainly there are points in a kid's life where they're ready for a certain kind of information. It's important not to push past that. Mm-hmm. But they tell us where they need to be. They kids communicate with us the kinds of information they're ready for. What happens more often is that parents aren't ready to give a open and full answer to their kids' questions in a way. I think that's the problem.
Bill, how often do you see maybe in your work as a sex therapist, or in perhaps in the past, have you seen problems in adulthood stemming from either a lack of education, a lack of good open communication, you know, some kind of development that wasn't really kind of holistic and playing out in adulthood?
So probably 80% of my caseload at one time was about lack of education. Hmm. And there's a wonderful book called Male Sexuality by Bernie Zilbergeld that I used to give to my clients and tell them what chapters to read, come back in 3 weeks, and probably 40% of them would call up and cancel the appointment and say, I fixed it. Thank you very much. So it was bad for business. Earlier you were asking about when to start talking about human sexuality. And there was a mentor of mine, Dr. Saul Gordon at Syracuse University. He published a whole bunch of books for parents and their kids about sexuality. And with both of my children, we read them to them, and they talked about human reproduction and how that happened with a penis and a vagina. And it was just one of the books, you know, that you read at night. It was just part of who they are. And so there is education out there, and it's called the internet. So for, you know, and there's a number of times where parents came in to me and wanted to talk with their children. There was usually a divide between the parents. One said now, and another one said it's too early. And I remember several couples, the age of the child was 18, so to have the talk, and I thought, that's probably a little late. But kids are getting their information off the internet, and they're also seeing tons of sexually explicit material that parents just don't think about, even though they have often parental controls. Parental controls are pretty easy to defeat. I would say that my kids and probably my grandkids know a lot more about computers than I will ever know. And some of the problems that we're seeing is that they're seeing sexualized violence in that sexually explicit material. Mm-hmm. So there's a message about how I'm supposed to be in a relationship and what that person is supposed to do. So that, I think, and you're not getting the information from people you trust, that's the problem. The other thing is that we're seeing something called sex is coping. A guy named Patrick Carnes coined the phrase sexual addiction, and most of us don't really see it as an addiction. But if I can watch sexually explicit material hours after hour after hour, I'm going to be drawn into that, and I'm going to use that so that I don't have to face the stresses of my life. And one of the problems is that if you do that, you have to look at things that are kinkier and kinkier. And so we're also seeing a lot of that, which we did not see 30 years ago because we didn't have the internet. And it's also something that a lot of the referrals from couples, it begins to affect the couple's relationship because one of the people is on the internet, either in chat rooms or watching sexually explicit material. And so they're finding their pleasure there rather than in their relationship. And that obviously causes major problems. So we're seeing things that we didn't see 18 years ago. So some of it's a lot different.
We have we've tried not to give too much away about the upcoming show on the life of Dr. Ruth. That's why we're here this hour talking about what's coming to the JCC Center Stage, opening tomorrow night, Becoming Dr. Ruth. And Karen Bowersock plays Dr. Ruth. Ralph Maranto, artistic director from JCC Center Stage. Are there any lines that sort of signify some of what we've been talking about, whether it's this idea that sex can be pleasurable, that should be pleasurable, that it should be something positive? Any lines from the show that stand out that you're allowed to reveal for us? And you don't have to do it in character. I'm not that guy. He's like, but now be Dr. Ruth.
Well, I can't stop myself. And my husband actually preferred it when I was doing the Irish accent, and that would creep in. But when Dr. Ruth creeps in on the house, it is not quite as enticing. But interestingly, she took a call on her radio show early on about talking to younger people. And somebody, you know, the child had walked, a five-year-old had walked in on her parents making love. And she says, you know, first of all, it is making love in any room of the house, on the floor, on the tables, anywhere is wonderful, so long as the doors have locks. Second, take your daughter aside and say, honey, when you walked in the other day, Daddy was not hurting Mommy. Daddy and Mommy made love and it felt good. Use that word, making love. If there is moaning and groaning, it is only because it feels good. And I think educating particularly young women, I would say as a woman, that it's okay to feel good, that this is a thing that feels good, is going to help women be more forward with their sexuality so they're not put in a position when they reach adolescence and their sexually active beginning of their sexual activity of saying, oh, this is a bad thing, I shouldn't be doing it, I have to hide it away, I have to keep it.
To feel it's shame. My,
yes, exactly. So that they're like, I'm out there to have some fun too. So,
and that's where I kind of want to go in the direction as we get ready for our last few minutes of this hour, is how that cultural shift happens. I mean, certainly people like Dr. Ruth have greatly helped it, whether it's in conversation, education, etc. But we still, I mean, I haven't been in high school in many years, but I talk to high school students. I've got family members. I have friends with kids of that age. And we still have a culture that where boys are kind of growing up talking to each other in the lunchroom the way I used to hear, which is, you know, get some. It's something to go get. And for girls being told, don't give it up. You know, withhold. It's shameful. And I think that's a cultural shift that still has to happen.
I absolutely. When Pebble was talking earlier about educating children about pleasure and educating and gender equality in other countries, I think that's where it starts. If we are equal in our abilities to pursue pleasure, to pursue sex, if we're encouraged to be equals as young girls, then it's not about a he makes the decision, I give it up or I don't give it up. You know, that he pursues women, and I'm not a in high school either anymore, but maybe young women are being more sexually aggressive or assertive of their own needs now and being able to say, yes, I have this desire and it's okay for me to pursue it.
Absolutely. I think that's so important. This is how adults play together. It should be something that we're doing together, not that somebody gets from somebody or somebody has to give up. It's play. It should be a team that we're on together, not teams that are at opposing sides.
How do we get there, though? I mean, what are the steps that you think still need to be taken so where that cultural change, or at least that's more of the norm as opposed to this, you know, dynamic that we see?
Do we have another 3 hours?
Yeah, I guess so.
I think talking about it. I think not
making it taboo.
Not making it taboo. Shame, sexual shame is a scourge. It's just really dangerous for people to feel alone and ashamed about themselves, their pleasure, their attractions. It's and I think if we can get rid of that shame, if we can help people understand that the sexual spectrum is vast, that the spectrum of everything is vast, and that diversity is to be valued and embraced and celebrated. And shame can be banished. That's our first step to getting back to a place where we're just playing together.
Is there a connection with a culture that doesn't view things the way that you idealistically sort of just envision for us, that has sort of the stunted idea of withhold, et cetera? Is there a connection to a kind of a broken culture on that and sexual violence?
Yeah. I mean, where sex is a commodity, that needs to be stolen,
taken, is
a part of that's a part of the power dynamic too. I mean, some of sexual violence is about sex. but most of sexual violence is about power. And that's where stealing and disrespect of the people involved gets activated.
And we have, you know, we have you guys as counselors, we have books, we have all kinds of information that's out there. But I think a lot of people get their early information from movies and television. And I think we have seen a shift in recent years about where the power play is between men and women in, on those types of programs.
Well, I think you're going to see, it sounds like you're going to see at the JCC Center Stage, the biography, the story of becoming Dr. Ruth, of someone who has been central in the evolution of this conversation.
Absolutely.
And the way we talk about sex, the way we talk about respect, pleasure, and love. And I hope that you enjoy being Dr. Ruth. You have become Dr. Ruth. Karen Bowersock, thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Nice having you. Have fun with the show. It starts tomorrow night at the JCC Center Stage. Online where, Ralph?
JCCRochester.org or 461-2000.
Can it run through?
Through the 21st of October, three weekends.
Thank you for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Nice to have you. And Dr. Kranz, nice having your expertise. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
From the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness, and Bill Kelly, thank you for your expertise.
Thank you.
As well. Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I will talk to you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.